So, imagine a diner walks into this really busy restaurant. They sit down and they order a microscopic crumb of food, literally just a crumb. But they demand that the restaurant reserve a massive, separate banquet table for every single crumb they order.
That's a demanding customer.
Right. And the restaurant, because it's following its own strict hospitality rules, it actually agrees. It sets up thousands of tables.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then the diner just sits there. They refuse to eat the crumbs and they refuse to ever leave the restaurant. So the place just quickly runs out of space for real paying customers.
Which is a huge problem.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And right now, that exact scenario is quietly taking down some of the biggest enterprise servers on the internet.
It really is.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is your Cyber Mornings Daily Briefing. Whether you're managing a massive enterprise network or, you're just insanely curious about the digital security landscape shaping our world, we know your time is valuable. Our goal today is to cut through the vendor panic, lose the jargon, and bring you three critical, practical cybersecurity stories you need to know.
Yeah, and we are looking at a really fascinating cross-section of the threat landscape today. We've got a flaw in how everyday computers handle simple web links, a fundamental breakdown in the actual rules that govern internet traffic, and finally, a look at how state-sponsored espionage groups are operating in the wild.
It's a packed board.
It is. And as we go through these, I really want you to keep an ear out for a surprising connection between all of them, because there is something here that is fundamentally changing how we have to think about network defense.
Oh, I love a good mystery. Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start on the client side, specifically with Microsoft Windows. There's a new vulnerability detailed by a researcher at Huntress, Andrew Schwartz. He found a flaw in the Windows Search URI handler. So for anyone who isn't a developer, what exactly is a URI handler? And well, why does Windows have a dedicated one for search?
So, a URI handler is basically a shortcut command built into the operating system. You actually use them all the time without realizing it.
Like when you click an email address.
Exactly, yeah. You click an email link on a website, and it automatically pops open your Outlook or Mail app. That is the Mailtoe URI handler doing its job. It tells the system, take this information and open the specific application designed to handle it.
Okay, got it.
So the search URI handler is just designed to open the Windows search function seamlessly.
Right, so as I click a link that starts with search, my local Windows search bar pops open. I mean, that seems harmless enough. Where does the vulnerability actually come in?
Well, it comes down to the parameters you can pass through that link. An attacker can send a specially crafted link that triggers the Windows search function, but it passes an additional parameter, specifically the crumb parameter.
The crumb parameter.
Yeah, crumb equals location. It tells the search function to look for files in a specific location, and they can point that location to a malicious remote server that they control,
Oh,
specifically an SMB server.
SMB, right? Which is the protocol Windows uses for sharing files and printers on a local network.
Precisely. And when your Windows machine tries to connect to that remote SMB server to perform the search, it automatically tries to authenticate itself.
Without you doing anything.
Without you doing anything other than clicking the link, it essentially knocks on the door of the attacker's server and says, "Hey, I'm trying to access this file share to run a search. Here are my credentials to prove who I am."
Oof.
Yeah. And in doing so, it hands over the user's NTLMv2 hash.
Okay, wait, let's pause there. What actually gets leaked? Because I hear the term hash thrown around all the time in these briefings. What does that practically mean for the listener? Is that just like my plain text password being sent over the internet?
No, it's not your plain text password, but for a skilled attacker, it can honestly be just as damaging. Think of a hash as a mathematical fingerprint of your password. Windows doesn't want to send your actual password over the network, right? So it uses a challenge response system. But if an attacker captures that mathematical fingerprint, they don't actually need to reverse engineer it to find out you used, password 123.
Right, they just have the fingerprint.
Exactly. They can just turn around and perform what is called a relay attack.
Okay, and how does a relay attack work in this context?
The attacker essentially acts as a middleman. They take your captured hash, turn around, and present it to another service on your internal network, maybe a critical database or an administrative portal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they just say, "Look, I have the valid fingerprint, let me in." And the internal server verifies the hash, assumes the attacker is you, and grants them access.
So they get to pivot deeper into the network without ever knowing the actual keystrokes of your password.
Exactly.
Okay, hang on though. I'm looking at the notes here, and this is the part that is really baffling to me.
Yeah.
Didn't Microsoft just fix this exact same mechanism?
Yes.
Because I remember reading a few months ago, back in, what, April 2026, about a flaw where the Windows snipping tool was leaking hashes in the exact same way when it tried to open a file path. And Veronis found a similar one before that in 2024.
You're remembering correctly. The mechanism is virtually identical. Researchers have pointed out multiple instances over the past year where different Windows features, like the snipping tool, were tricked into reaching out to malicious SMB servers and leaking hashes.
Right, and in those cases, Microsoft issued patches to stop it.
They did.
So if they fixed the snipping tool doing this, why on earth are they leaving the door wide open for the Windows search function? I mean, they were notified about this new flaw in April, but they declined to issue a patch.
Yeah, they said it only met their moderate severity rating.
Right, so is this like a technical limitation where search is just harder to fix? Or is this a conscious policy choice? It feels like having a security guard who checks an ID but then shouts the person's home address to an attacker standing outside.
That's a great analogy. And what's fascinating here is it's almost certainly a policy and resource allocation choice. It gives us a really stark look into vendor risk acceptance.
Yeah, so?
Well, every major software vendor operates on a triage matrix. When a bug is reported, it gets scored based on how hard it is to exploit and how much damage it can do, because this specific flaw requires user interaction.
Meaning I have to actually click the link.
Exactly, meaning you, the victim, have to actively click the malicious link in an email or a document. That lowers the severity score in their internal matrix.
I see.
They likely decided that the engineering effort required to rewrite how the search URI validates network paths across every supported version of Windows just wasn't worth the return on investment for a threat they deem moderate.
Wow. So they accept the risk, but I am the one left exposed.
Yeah.
That is a wildly frustrating position for a network defender. If we can't wait around for a software patch that isn't coming, what's the practical takeaway here? Mm-hmm. What do you actually do today to secure a network against this?
Since you cannot fix the software flaw, you have to sever the attacker's ability to use the protocol.
Good.
First, you need to block outbound SMB traffic. That means blocking TCP ports 445 and 139 at your firewall for any host that doesn't absolutely need it.
Which is most of them, right?
Yeah, let's be real. There is almost never a legitimate reason for a standard employee workstation to be initiating a file sharing connection to a random server on the public internet.
That makes sense. Cut off the road the attacker's trying to drive on.
Exactly. Second, if you're managing a network, you must enforce SMB signing internally. Think of SMB signing like a tamper-proof wax seal on a letter.
Okay.
If an attacker captures your hash and tries to relay it to another server, SMB signing ensures the receiving server validates exactly where the request originated.
So the relay fails.
Right. If the origin doesn't match the signature, the server rejects it. It stops relay attacks dead in their tracks.
Nice.
And finally, if your legacy systems allow for it, just disable NTLM authentication entirely and move to more modern protocols like Kerberos.
Okay, so that's what happens when a software giant just decides not to fix a specific client-side feature. But what happens when the actual rulebook of the internet itself has a flaw?
Yeah, that is a major shift in scale. We're moving from a single operating system quirk to a protocol-level meltdown that impacts a massive chunk of the global web infrastructure.
Let's get into our second story. This is the HTTP2 bomb.
Yes.
Discovered by a security firm called Caliph, and incredibly, they use an AI tool, OpenAI Codex, to help uncover it.
Which is wild.
It is. And this is a remote denial of service exploit. The list of affected servers reads like a who's who of the internet backbone. We're talking NGINX, Apache, Microsoft IS, Envoy, Cloudflare, Pingora.
All the heavy hitters.
They're all vulnerable based on their default configurations. So to understand this, we really need to talk about how web servers compress data.
We do. When the internet transitioned from the older HTTP 1.1 protocol to HTTP 2, one of the biggest goals was efficiency. In the old days, every time you asked a server for a web page, your browser sent a lot of repetitive metadata. Headers telling the server what browser you were using, what languages you accept, your authentication cookie.
Just a lot of bloated, redundant text.
Exactly. And sending all that text back and forth slows down the connection. So HTTP 2 introduced a dedicated compression system called HPACK.
HPACK.
It was a brilliant upgrade. By compressing all those headers, they reduced the size of the data traveling over the wire by about 30%, which significantly sped up the web.
But the Califf researchers found a way to use this exact efficiency system to create a compression bomb.
They did.
So a compression bomb, is that like a zip file that expands into petabytes of junk data and crashes your hard drive?
It's the same concept, yeah, but happening in the server's active memory instead of a hard drive. The attacker sends a tiny, highly compressed string of bytes. But because of how HPPA works, it forces the server to allocate a full, uncompressed header in its memory. And the attacker repeats this thousands of times within a single request.
But wait, servers have defenses against this, don't they? My understanding is that classic compression bomb attacks work by stuffing a massive bloated value into a table. And over the years, servers learned to catch that by putting a hard cap on the total size of the decoded header.
And that is the genius of this new variant. It goes the exact opposite direction. The header being sent by the attacker is practically empty. There is almost no data in it.
Hang on, the math on this HTTPP2 thing isn't adding up for me.
Oh, okay.
If the header is basically empty, how on earth does it cause a massive enterprise-grade server to run out of memory and crash?
Because classic defense mechanisms are looking for massive file sizes. Mm-hmm. The server checks the payload, says, oh, this is a tiny file, let it through. The decoded size limit never triggers.
Oh.
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the massive memory amplification doesn't come from the size of the payload itself. It comes from the per-entry bookkeeping.
Wait, bookkeeping?
Remember that restaurant analogy you used at the start? The diner ordering the single crumb? Every time the server processes one of those tiny empty headers, it has to do administrative work. It has to allocate internal memory pointers, create data structures, track the state of that request.
It sets up an entire banquet table for a crumb.
Exactly. So it's not the food taking up space, it's the infrastructure required to serve it.
Right.
And HTTP2 introduced another feature called multiplexing, which allows multiple requests to flow over a single connection.
Right.
To manage the flow of all these requests, it uses something called a flow control window. In this exploit, the attacker sends a zero-byte flow control window.
What does that mean in plain English?
It means the attacker politely asks the server to pause sending any data back. The attacker says, hey, I'm not ready to receive anything, please hold.
And the server just listens.
The server, following the rules of the protocol, agrees. It waits. But the attacker never gives the green light. So the server is forced to hold that connection open indefinitely.
Pinning all of those empty banquet tables in its active memory.
Yes. It never frees them up. And because it never frees them up, the server eventually just runs out of RAM and crashes.
That is insane. What kind of scale are we talking about here?
A single home computer running on a standard 100 megabit per second connection can use this specific technique to consume 32 gigabytes of server memory in about 20 seconds.
32 gigs in 20 seconds.
Hmm.
From one home computer.
Against targets like Apache and Envoy, yeah.
That is staggering. How did the architects of the internet miss this?
Well, the underlying failure is in the specification itself. The spec wrongly framed memory risk purely as an amplification ratio.
Okay.
But a massive amplification ratio is actually totally harmless if the memory is freed the moment the request completes. It only becomes a devastating attack because HTTP2 allows the client to hold the connection open almost for free.
Keeping every single byte of that administrative overhead pinned for as long as they want.
Exactly.
So what is the practical impact here? If I'm a network admin listening to this right now, how do I defend against a flaw in the actual rules of the internet?
You have to cap the limits manually. If you're running NGINX or Apache HTTPD, there are recent patches available. NGINX 1.29.8 and higher, for example, introduces a max headers default of 1,000.
Okay, so that cuts off the bomb's ability to span thousands of entries.
Right. Apache is fixed in ModHttp2 version 2.0.41. But if you are on an architecture that hasn't released a patch yet, like some versions of ISA or certain cloud proxies like Bingora,
what do you do?
Your only real mitigation is a drastic one. You have to downgrade. You have to disable HTTP2 entirely on your server and force clients to use the older, uncompressed HTTP 1.1 protocol until a fix is available.
Which means sacrificing all that speed and efficiency just to stay online.
Yeah.
That is a harsh reality. So we've looked at an unpatched OS bug and an AI-discovered protocol meltdown. Now let's look at how human intelligence and state-sponsored actors actually string these kinds of vulnerabilities together in the real world.
Yeah, this is where theory meets practice. And it is usually a lot messier and more pragmatic than people expect.
Our third story focuses on a threat intelligence report from the French cybersecurity firm Sequoia back in January 2026. They're detailing an ongoing campaign by a hacking group known as Gamaradon.
Right.
And Sequoia officially links this group to the Russian Federal Security Service, the FSB, noting their targeting of Ukrainian government, military, and critical infrastructure.
When you analyze the infection chain detailed in this report, you don't see a single flashy multi-million-dollar superweapon.
No.
No. You see a highly obfuscated, deeply modular design built purely for resilience.
It starts pretty simply, actually. The initial compromise is just a spear phishing email containing a booby-trapped zip or RRR archive.
Yeah.
And if the victim opens it, it exploits a known path traversal flaw in the WinRAR software, specifically CVE-2025-AZO-88. But I got to push back here.
Okay.
If this is a state-sponsored group, supposedly with massive funding and advanced capabilities, why are they relying on a known patch bug in WinRAR and tricking users with weaponized USB drives and shortcut files? And they have a stockpile of 0 days.
They probably do. But in long-term cyber operations, economics and resilience dictate strategy. You do not burn a highly valuable secret zero-day exploit on an initial phishing email if a simple old WinRAR trick still works on a significant percentage of your targets.
Right. Why use the expensive tool when the cheap one works?
Exactly. Their strategy is all about living off the land and being adaptable.
So what happens after that WinRAR trick works? I know it's a whole chain of events.
It acts like a Russian nesting doll.
Right.
The WinRAR exploit drops a tiny HTML application called GammaFish.
GammaFish, okay.
That application does nothing but run a simple VBScript downloader called GammaLoad. That script does nothing but reach out to the internet to download the actual malware module.
So everything is compartmentalized.
Highly compartmentalized. Eventually, it pulls down two main tools. GammaWorm, which is designed for spreading across the local network and maintaining persistence. And GammaSteal, which is an information stealer.
GammaSteal. And here's where it gets really interesting. Yeah. We always picture malware communicating with some shady server in a foreign country, right? Some dark web IP address.
Sure.
But to get its commands, this GammaWorm malware uses a hard-coded, totally public Telegram channel.
Yep.
And when GammaSteal actually steals the classified files, it exfiltrates them straight into an Amazon Web Services cloud storage bucket.
Mm-hmm.
An S3 bucket.
It's brilliant in its simplicity.
It's like a spy conducting a dead drop, exchanging top secret information right in the middle of a crowded, noisy shopping mall.
I just still can't.
You just blend in perfectly.
That is a perfect analogy, and it's an incredibly effective evasion technique. Think about it. If you are a network defender, you're sitting in a security operations center watching millions of connections fly by.
Right.
Seeing a workstation reach out to Telegram or AWS is entirely normal. AWS hosts half the internet. Telegram is a widely used messaging app.
So it doesn't trigger the automated alarms the way a connection to an unknown IP address would.
Exactly. They are hiding in the overwhelming noise of legitimate, everyday web traffic. And this isn't isolated, by the way. Researchers see similar tactics from other clusters targeting Ukraine, using everyday tools to drop payloads.
Which brings up a terrifying problem for defenders. You can't just block AWS at the firewall, or your whole company stops working.
You can't.
So what is the practical takeaway for the listener here? How do you defend against an adversary who only uses tools you already trust?
It requires a fundamental shift in how you monitor your environment. You have to move beyond traditional signature-based detection.
Meaning just looking for known bad files.
Right. If your security relies solely on a checklist of known bad domains or malicious file hashes, you will miss this entirely. You have to start hunting for behavioral anomalies based on context.
Give me an example of what that looks like in practice.
You have to ask contextual questions. Why is an accounting workstation, which normally only accesses internal databases, suddenly sending a massive encrypted burst of data to an AWS bucket at 3 a.m. on a Sunday? Even though AWS is a trusted platform, the behavior itself is anomalous for that specific machine and that specific user. You're no longer looking for bad tools. You're looking for normal tools being used in weird ways.
Wow. You know, we started this briefing aiming to cut through the noise. And when you pull these three stories together, a very stark reality emerges.
It does.
Attackers aren't necessarily hacking in the traditional movie sense where they break through firewalls with glowing green code.
Not at all.
They are logging in using stolen NTLM hashes leaked by a simple Windows search command. They're crashing massive enterprise servers by politely asking them to hold the door open using the standard HTTP2 protocol.
Mm-hmm.
And state-sponsored actors are stealing national secrets by hiding in plain sight on Telegram and AWS.
And that brings us to the connection I mentioned at the very beginning of our briefing. It's a realization that is redefining how we think about security. Across all three of these stories, the attackers succeeded not by breaking the rules of the code, but by exploiting the intended logic of the systems.
The systems were doing exactly what they were designed to do.
Exactly. Microsoft intended for URIs to seamlessly open network locations to make the user experience smoother.
Right.
The architects of the internet intended for HTTP2 connections to stay open efficiently to speed up the web, and network administrators intend for traffic to major cloud platforms like AWS to flow freely without interruption to keep businesses running. The attackers are simply weaponizing our own desire for efficiency and convenience.
This raises an important question for everyone listening. If our entire cybersecurity defense paradigm is built around identifying abnormal or malicious behavior, how do you defend a network where every single step of a devastating attack is built entirely out of perfectly normal, legitimate features?
That is the paradox we are currently living in, and it's something every security team needs to grapple with. You have to completely redefine what normal means for your specific environment, because the attackers already know the rules better than we do.
That is a lot to think about and a critical lens to apply to your own networks. That is our briefing for today. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the daily threat landscape. Take these actionable insights, look closely at how your own systems define normal behavior, and stay secure out there.